Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC, and Dan Savage is back with us now, the widely read Savage Love sex advice columnist, maybe best known for starting the It Gets Better movement. You also might know him from his appearances on Colbert, Bill Maher, This American Life, and more. His new book is called American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. It's a collection of essays in which his son comes out to him as straight. He critiques comprehensive sex education as not comprehensive enough, and he says it's never okay to cheat on your spouse except when it is, and much more. Hey, Dan Savage, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back. It's great to talk with you again.
And I thought we might dig in on a couple of your pieces and take some calls on each, and I thought the never okay to cheat except when it is chapter was a brave and candid one. So let's start with that. You wrote that you get a lot of mail at Savage Love from people stuck in various kinds of sexless marriages, mostly heterosexual, who say their marriages are good in other ways and ask you if it's okay to cheat. Can you talk first maybe about some of the common scenarios?
Well, often what happens in a multi-decade long-term relationship, sometimes the sex goes away, but everything else is still working and fine. The examples I get are people writing saying, I've been with my husband for 20 years. We have three small children. We haven't had sex in a decade. We go to marriage counseling. We've talked about it, gone to couples counseling. We've done all the things that people tell you you're supposed to do, and nothing works, but we love each other. But my husband just won't, consider any sort of open relationship and can't meet my needs. And it's just sexually shut down in every way. What do I do? And those are the cases I look at and go, well, you could divorce, which is, ironically, there's an article I cite in the book that CNN wrote an article about saving the sexless marriage. And before ethical non-monogamy, which was an option that they trotted out, before that, the recommendation before open relationship was divorce, because divorce is likelier to save your marriage, to save your sexless marriage, than non-monogamy. And I look at those cases going, sometimes cheating is the least worst option. Sometimes cheating is, if it's a violation of the commitment you've made, okay, it's a betrayal, it's this, it's that. But a divorce would be a bigger betrayal of your kids, even of your partner.
So listeners, does anyone have a story like this to share about yourself or about someone you know? It might help others in this not that uncommon situation, unfortunately. Or are you in or know someone in a situation like this and want to ask Dan Savage an advice question? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 on the chapter in Dan Savage's new book in which he says it's never okay to cheat except when it is. Your stories or your questions for advice, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Did you make up that phrase that you just used, ethical non-monogamy?
No, I wish I did. Ethical non-monogamy, open relationships. I made up the term monogamish, which is I invented to describe my relationship with my husband. Because, we're a gay couple, we're parents. If we're honest and tell people that we're not monogamous, as a gay couple, people presume a level of sort of screwing around promiscuity that it was no way true of us. Even other gay people would assume that we were crazy sexually, out there. And we were so much more monogamous than not that I started calling us monogamish as opposed to monogamists. And that's my term, and it's caught on. It's very popular with a lot of straight people.
Yeah, I've heard that term. I didn't realize it was you. But it is still the very rare marriage of whatever sexual orientation where people can handle an open marriage, isn't it?
Well, most long-term same-sex couples are actually in open relationships where there's some accommodation and understanding, usually explicit understanding and agreement hammered out between the partners about what is and is not permissible. To be gay, you have to tell a very uncomfortable truth about yourself to your parents, often when you're very young. And it sets you on this path of kind of telling uncomfortable truths or telling your truth about your sexuality, just generally and broadly. And then you meet, you fall in love with somebody, and non-monogamy is very common in gay, long-term committed gay relationships, and ethical, honest, open, disclosed non-monogamy. There's a lot of people out there who are straight, who are in non-monogamous or monogamous relationships. I'm always telling people who say that, no, you know, open relationships, they always fail. I've never known anyone who was in an open relationship where they didn't wind up breaking up. Mm. Well, you know people who are in open relationships. You don't know you know them. You know people in long-term successful open relationships, but you don't know it, because most straight people who are monogamous or they have some understanding or agreement that allows for outside sexual contact, they're not out about it because the stigma is so great. So there's a lot of straight couples out there who are open and successful, and you never hear about them. You hear about the ones where it, you know, where there was cheating or an open relationship that ended and perhaps the openness contributed to the end. You hear about those, mm-hmm. but you never, ever, if you're straight.
The ones that actually work out.
Yeah, if your parents are swingers, you don't know it.
Roy in the East Village, you're on WNYC with Dan Savage. Hi, Roy.
Well, thanks, Brian and Dan, for taking my call. It's a very interesting topic. I was just curious if Dan can give me some information, or the audience, I should say. Suppose in some instance where there's medication that might cause impotence on the part of the male, or who knows, even the female, what would his advice be under those circumstances? Because obviously that's not a situation that is in their immediate control.
It isn't. And, you know, there are some people who are on antidepressants that are libido killers. And there are other, you know, life intervenes. And sometimes people have medical conditions that can render them male and female. It's not just something that can affect the male. It's someone who can't have sex anymore. The man is impotent, or there's too much pain, or just a lack of interest that makes sexual activity painful. And you have to look at that relationship and say, okay, is everything else that we are about, love, commitment, a history together, the physical day-to-day intimacy of a shared life, should all that have to be sacrificed and set aside and left behind if I'm ever going to have sex again in my life? Or can we have a don't ask, don't tell agreement? Can we acknowledge that sex isn't a defining aspect of our marriage and our commitment to one another, and then outsource those needs elsewhere and go elsewhere?
And does it matter what the cause is? Because I think Roy's question was, like, what about a case where the inability to have sex or desire sex is caused by a medication? Is that different than any other?
I'm not about assigning blame, although, you know, there are some cases where people just reject their partner and reject their partner and reject their partner.
Right.
And that can be very cruel over the decades. So that it's a medical condition. I would hope that if I was ever medically incapacitated and couldn't have sex anymore, that my attitude toward my partner would be, because this has happened to me and I'm incapable of having sex. There's other kinds of sex and intimacy that we can enjoy, but if I'm incapable of having sex myself or performing, that I would hope I would go to him and say, you know, do what you need to do to stay married and stay sane. Mm-hmm. And with my blessing, you know, I want to be with you, but I don't want you to have to miss out on this pleasure of life for the rest of your life. I don't want that to be a consequence of loving me and being committed to me. And that would be my recommendation to other people in that situation.
And let's take another call. Eileen in Hartsdale, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Eileen.
Good morning. I guess it's a very interesting topic for me, because I have been in a sexless marriage for many years, and I met someone who was also in one, and we discussed it between ourselves. We got together. We've been having a 5-year affair. And none of our spouses know. We didn't want to break up any families. We both have children. We're both married. We're in happy marriages that have this element that's missing, that's very important. But by our relationship, for some reason, it has brought us closer to our spouses.
You often hear that when people do reports on this, when you look into open marriages, even, you know, I'm not shaming you or guilting you, and I think that you guys have come to an accommodation that works. And it may have even saved your marriage. You know, when cheating destroys a marriage, everyone screams and yells and jumps upside down about how dangerous cheating is. Here's a case where cheating may have saved two marriages.
But let me be clear. Eileen, you said neither of you have told your spouses, right?
No, we do not have open marriages.
That's why I called it.
Not be a good idea.
That's why I called this check technically cheating. This isn't quote-unquote ethical non-monogamy, because there's not the consent of all involved, right? But this is a case where cheating, quote-unquote, saved two marriages. And so when cheating destroys a marriage, everybody hears about it and we all go clucking our tongues about how awful cheating is. When cheating saves two marriages, it doesn't get any credit.
Well, it's a very fine line because the marriage is not bad and you don't want to destroy a marriage when it has the component of a family. But if something is missing, there you can't, I mean, a person sometimes looks for it and it doesn't mean they have to break up what they have to get it.
Well, it sounds like a success story all the way around. Dan, forgive me, is there any circumstance under which you would say to someone like Eileen, you really, in order to be open, should be telling your spouses about this? I'm guessing you won't say that.
Well, there are some spouses who don't want to know. And there's sometimes when you have to go, you know, many people who are married have had conversations about cheating hypothetically. Like, if that ever happened, how would I react? What would we do? And they've been told by their spouses that, you know, cheating for me is a deal breaker and it would be the end of the marriage. And then they're sexless for 10 years and they have this opportunity. And they think, well, I'm not cheating my partner of anything my partner wants, because clearly my partner isn't interested in sex. But if I disclose, it's going to destroy the marriage. And it's sort of this horrible Hobson's choice. And people then have to take the path of the least worst option, I think. And often the least worst option is to cheat. I often tell people who are in long-term sexless marriages that what they should say in advance of launching an affair is to go to your spouse and say, look, I love you, I'm staying, we're committed, we're great together, you're my best friend. Clearly sex isn't necessary for us to love each other and be committed to each other because we don't have sex. And we've worked on it and nothing seems to work, but I'm never going to go anywhere. And I just want you to know that if the opportunity ever presents itself and you want to go for it with somebody else, please do so discreetly and I don't want to know about it. And you know what? I'll do the same for you. And you've sort of given your spouse permission to do what you're already planning to do or maybe already doing, and at the same time acknowledging how you would like it done and how you're doing it discreetly with some consideration and care, and you're going to have a don't ask, don't tell policy with each other about that.
Eileen, good luck to all your families. My guest, Dan Savage of the Savage Love, very popular sex advice column and the It Gets Better movement, or you know him from Colbert and Bill Maher and This American Life, and his new book is American Savage. And we're talking for the moment about this one particular chapter in it about people who have sex out of marriage when their marriages are sexless, but they want to actually stay married. And you have an interesting footnote in that chapter pointing out that almost all the sexless marriage mail that you get from readers is from people in heterosexual marriage. And you have a few theories about why that applies to both gay male marrieds and lesbian marrieds. Can you tell everybody your thinking on that?
Oh, my God, I don't remember those footnotes that I wrote. Can you tell me what I said?
Well, I think you said basically that gay males in, you know, married or committed relationships like yourself tend to be a little bit more likely to have open marriages than heterosexuals.
With respect to lesbians,
there's actually just less desire for non-monogamy, and so it just doesn't come up so much for people to write into you about it as a problem.
Well, true. You know, there are people who run around the country saying gay people shouldn't be allowed to marry because gay men are so bad at monogamy. And when you look at the research, gay men are bad at monogamy or good at non-monogamy, depending on how you look at it. But gay men are bad at monogamy. Straight couples are better at it. And lesbian couples are the best at being successfully monogamous. So if monogamy is something we want to prioritize in the awarding of marriage licenses, we should only let lesbians get married.
Huh.
But I really think that the difference for a lot of gay couples, and we have to acknowledge there are gay monogamous couples out there, but the research shows that they're in the minority of long-term gay male couples. But gay, you know, to be gay is to constantly be negotiating about sex. For straight people, you get to consent, you get to, you know, agreeing to have sex with each other, and you stop communicating because everything after that is assumed. There's these defaults in heterosexual sex, you know, vaginal intercourse. That's what you do when you have straight sex. When two men are going to have sex, they have to talk about what happens then. You get to consent, and then you start talking about what happens to who and who wants to do what. And that conversation spills over into our relationships. And, you know, when you have two men who are both men, I think you have a bit more realism and a bit less cultural baggage about who polices the borders of what's an acceptable relationship, who polices the borders of monogamy. There's a lot of unhappy heterosexuals out there, heterosexual couples, where the male feels constrained and the woman feels like she's trapped being, you know, the keeper of the monogamous flame. And that's not a role that women particularly enjoy, and nor is it a role that inspires a great deal of lust in women. You know, the research does show that most sexless marriages, it is the woman who has the lower cratered libido and the lack of desire. And people are at work on this. And, you know, it seems to be that the problem is the relationship model that we've created for people extinguishes desire.
You know, it also reminds me, this curve that you lay out where gay men are the most promiscuous, heterosexual marriages second, lesbians least. It reminds me of the early days of AIDS, when the religious right would say, aha, this epidemic among gay men proves that homosexuality is a sin. Mm-hmm. But they would leave out the fact that lesbians had the lowest rates of AIDS of any group,
lowest rates of sexually transmitted infections, period.
Right. Lower than straight people because of the way the virus is transmitted. It's just an interesting historical footnote, I think, parallel.
It is. They never want to talk about lesbians. You know, a lot of people who oppose same-sex marriages or same-sex relationships, it's always focusing on gay men. Often, if I can maybe crude, focusing on our rear ends. There's this obsession with anal intercourse. You know, that's disgusting. It's dirty. It shouldn't be done. And they ignore, of course, all the research that shows that a huge percentage of straight people have engaged in and regularly engage in anal intercourse as well. Everybody has a butt. And again, if you want to award marriage licenses to people who are least likely to have anal sex, that would be lesbians. Only lesbians should be able to be married based on the criteria that the religious right trots out to deny marriage licenses to queer people.
And I guess we just learn again that no matter what your sexual orientation is, men are more likely to be non-monogamous than women. So we will continue with Dan Savage, and we'll turn to another of the stories in his new book, American Savage, about a teenage boy who struggles with coming out to his gay parents. We'll pick it up there when we continue with Dan Savage. WNYC, and Dan Savage is back with us now, the widely read Savage Love sex advice columnist, who may be best known for starting the It Gets Better movement. You might also know him from his appearances on Colbert, Bill Maher, This American Life, and more. His new book is called American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. Hi again, Dan.
Hey, Brian.
And I'll just mention, because I didn't know it in the first half, so I apologize for not mentioning it then, that Dan's new web series, It Got Better, premiered on Wednesday on L Studio. That's lstudio.com. The first episode featured Glee star Jane Lynch. Future episodes will feature NBA player Jason Collins, Project One Runway host Tim Gunn, musicians Tegan and Sarah, and actors George Takei and Laverne Cox. And before we turn to the second of the stories in your book that I said we were going to talk about a teenage boy who struggles with coming out to his parents as straight, since we just mentioned It Gets Better and It Got Better, do you want to give us an update on that? You started such a meme online with people really affirming to young folks who've recently come out as gay or lesbian and are struggling with it that it gets better as you get older. Now you're saying it got better. Does that mean mission accomplished?
No, it doesn't. There are still LGBT kids out there who are being rejected and harassed and bullied. There are still quote-unquote faith leaders out there who are encouraging parents to do what we know doubles a queer kid's already quadrupled risk of suicide. People advise parents to reject their gay kids when they come out, and that puts them in tremendous peril. So it's not over, and the struggle isn't over, and not every queer kid is safe. What the past tense of the It Gets Better campaign, just these six films, do is it interviews different prominent queer people of different ages, about how things turned around for them, what their struggles were like. And what I love about the series is it focuses chronologically. So you learn a bit about the history of the LGBT civil rights movement from, you know, the gay perspective, George Takei, trans perspective from Laverne Cox, and other elements of it. And it's very positive and very powerful. And it does sort of, you know, what the It Gets Better project did for queer kids and continues to do. You know, it was sort of huge and viral in 2010 and into 2011. And it created this tremendous archive online, this resource for queer kids who are coming out. Because when you think about being the queer kid who's coming out, you don't have the benefit of being around other adults who've struggled the way you're struggling. You know, a kid who's African-American and is being bullied at school goes home to African-American family, African-American parents, who will defend their kid, who the kid can open up to about what they're suffering. All too often, the queer kid goes home to parents who are also bullying them. And what the project did is created this place where adult queer people could illuminate that path between bullied childhood and successful queer adulthood. And there's 250,000 videos now. Most of them, there's only a couple of hundred by politicians or actors or corporations. The vast and overwhelming majority are everyday ordinary people letting queer kids know that you can live a happy, successful life full of love and joy. And that's in store for you. And most of us were bullied. Most of us suffered just as you're suffering, and we got through it, and so can you.
And so the Through the Looking Glass story in your book is about a teenage boy who struggles with coming out to his gay parents as straight. And spoiler alert, everybody, one of the gay parents is Dan Savage. So, Dan, you want to tell us about your son and how he came out to you?
He came out to us when he was a very small child. You know, my mom would say now that she always knew I was gay, even though she was in tremendous denial about it. She was of the generation where they couldn't figure out whether Liberace was gay or not. So it didn't matter how gay a kid I was, she couldn't quite figure it out. My kid was always very, very sort of gender conforming and very straight, and trucks and explosions. And we kind of always had him figured for straight. And he would insist to us that he was gay when he was a small kid. Because he thought being gay meant you got to live with your best friend all your life. And he thought when he was 9 or 10 that because he didn't like girls, that meant he was going to be gay when he grew up. And we had to tell him when we were your age, we loved girls. You know, that not liking girls when you're a 9-year-old boy is not a sign that you're going to be a homosexual when you're an adult.
Right, maybe the opposite.
Yeah, quite the opposite. And he sort of doubled and tripled down on him insisting that girls were gross, therefore he would be gay when he grew up. And it kind of broke our hearts because we were always really clear with him that whoever he was, we would love him and we will always love him. Whoever he was sexually, whoever he was gender-wise, whatever, we love him.
So to be clear, it didn't break your hearts that he turned out straight. It broke your hearts that he thought that to please you, he needed to be gay.
It broke our hearts that he thought we might have a problem with it. It broke our hearts that he hesitated when it was time, you know, to tell us. It kind of broke our hearts that he told, you know, he did what I did when I was first coming out as gay, is I didn't tell my family first because that was too dangerous and seemed too consequential. The stakes were too high. I told somebody on the periphery first to see how they would react. And he told a neighbor before he told us. But it wasn't something he needed to tell us because we kind of knew, but it just had never been confirmed. And he was really concerned that we might be upset. And that was heartbreaking because we thought we had done everything right, but we thought we had communicated to him that we loved him. I'd heard some other gay parents talk to their kids about sexuality and sort of they made it sound like a coin toss. There's a 50-50 chance you'd be gay or straight. And we'd always made it clear to him that most people in the world are straight. I remember one night we sat down when he had an earache and he and I sat and made a list because he said he was going to be gay when he grows up. And I was like, well, you don't know. Well, you can't know that yet. And you'll find out later. But we sat down and made a list of all the couples that we knew in our lives, you know, his grandparents, our neighbors, his babysitter and her boyfriend. I just made this long list of all the couples and then looked at it and said, well, look at this. All these people, most people fall in love with opposite sex partners. So, you know, the odds are not 50-50. The odds are 90-10. And having even done all that, it just, you know, what was heartbreaking is there's something about us, I guess, something about just, you know, this desire to please your parents or be like your parents that made him wonder whether he would we would have a problem with it, or we would not be welcoming and accepting. And as a gay parent, to be in that position was just so staggering. The lesson I draw in that chapter, though, is really for religious conservatives. You know, I bring it back to politics always. Religious conservatives who argue that gay people shouldn't be allowed to parent because our kids will be gay when they grow up. Our kids will want to adopt our sexuality when they grow up. And here's this kid who didn't have gay parents. This is a kid with the gayest parents. Terry and I are about as gay as people get. And he wanted to adopt our sexuality. He said he was going to be gay. He had this desire to be like us and couldn't do it because sexuality is not a choice.
And as kind of an addendum, I see in that chapter, you thank some of the unlikeliest people for helping ramp up the gay parenting movement. Rick Santorum, Mike Huckabee, Pope Benedict.
Yeah, the irony, another irony of gay people in parenting is the states with the highest percentage of gay parents per capita are not California and Washington State or New York. It's Mississippi. It's Utah. It's these religious conservative states. Most of these people who are gay parents in these states had children in heterosexual relationships and then divorced. These are people who marry young in the Bible Belt, who are gay, who think they can never come out. And so they throw themselves into a heterosexual partnership. Yeah. They have a couple of kids, and then they realize they can't live in the closet all their lives.
And that has to be the last word because we are flat out of time. Dan Savage's new web series, It Got Better, has premiered on lstudio.com, and his new book, American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. Great to have you. Thanks a lot. Good luck.
Thanks, Ryan.
Talk to you tomorrow with a family meeting on laughter. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.